Two great tenors, Dexter Gordon and Johnny Griffin, take the lead on Blues Up and Down with George Cables on piano, Rufus Reed on bass, Eddie Gladden on drums. This was a memorable performance live at New York's Carnegie Hall in 1976. This is Lead Stories. I'm Retrice Lead. And if it gets any weirder than this, in terms of where the news is taking us, I don't know what's going to happen, but we proceed just the same. Today, we're going to be talking about a call out of Utah, a demand for answers about the Clinton Foundation out of Utah. An editorial appearing today in West Virginia's The Intelligencer raises an interesting question titled, Take a Critical Look at Charitable Foundation Abuse. It says, quote, New York's Attorney General has filed a lawsuit against President Donald Trump and his charitable foundation, accusing them of using money illegally to help his businesses and political campaign. Whether the action has any merit remains to be seen. But while we are thinking of abuses involving charitable foundations, what about Hillary and Bill Clinton? Why did the matter of their foundation and millions of dollars from Russia get swept under the carpet? Inquiring minds, of course, for years have been demanding answers to this and other important questions concerning the operations of the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation and the labyrinth of spin-off projects and programs associated with it. No answers so far, really. Not even from the Justice Department's recently released 568-page Inspector General's report on how the DOJ and the FBI handled their probes into Hillary Clinton's use of a secret server when she was Secretary of State. But simply because they have not given answers doesn't mean that there aren't any. As you know, Charles Ortel, who has been with us, well, we've been hooked up for years, a couple of years, following the Clinton Foundation and its rather shady operations. Well, he's with us again today, and we're going to try and see how much closer we get to answering the question raised in the Intelligencer's editorial this morning. He, as you know, is a retired Wall Street banker who has spent years crusading against charity fraud and, most specifically, quote, the largest unprosecuted charitable fraud in history, unquote, referring to the Clinton Foundation. So he's with us to discuss the significance of the Intelligencer's push for answers today. Charles, great to have you with us.
An honor to be back on you, Trees. Hope all is well.
Well, let's discuss this interesting editorial this morning coming from Utah. Geographically, that's a very interesting place. And of course, for the newspaper from there, what is the significance of Utah?
Well, and of West Virginia, it's very significant. We start, I'll answer your question, if I may, talking first about West Virginia. West Virginia is the only, there are two states in the United States that have barred either the main Clinton Foundation or a piece of the Clinton Foundation from soliciting and operating. One of those states is West Virginia. And so it's quite, they don't go down that rabbit hole in the short article, but the way our system is supposed to work is if a charity, a large charity like the Clinton Foundation, operating in all 50 states in Washington, D.C., gets into trouble in one state, it's supposed to tell virtually all the other states that it got into trouble. So why they got bounced in West Virginia is that on three occasions, starting in, I think, 2000, the Clinton Foundation illegally solicited funds in the great state of Mississippi and got tagged in a series of actions and had to sign agreements paying fines for soliciting illegally. And West Virginia found out about that and said, not in our state. This is early days when this happened. Later on, in about 2005 time frame, it might have been 4 or 5 or 6 in that time frame, the Clinton Foundation certainly didn't tell the great state of Utah that it had these problems in Mississippi, which had been picked up by West Virginia. And in the file that we have obtained from Utah, we discover that the auditor of Utah asked probing questions of the Clinton Foundation. And rather than answer those questions and continue to try to abide by the law in Utah, the Clinton Foundation said, we don't have enough money to do this. It's too complicated. We're not going to refile our returns. We're just not ever going to raise money again in the state of Utah. Well, you're not allowed to do that. You know, when you are disciplined by the state of Utah, you're supposed to tell, you know, every other state where you're registered and soliciting what happened, and they haven't done that. That correspondence is out there. Anybody can see it in the public domain. Now to answer your question, why this matters enormously is that, as for personal returns, the IRS has various places where it requires the federal tax return to be sent. It so happens that the office of the IRS, where the Clinton Foundation has sent many returns, because it's based there in Arkansas, is in Ogden, Utah, the very state which appears to be the headquarters state for the group of newspapers of which the West Virginia title wrote that one piece. So it's very significant also because we know that the U.S. attorney in Utah is in fact believed to be one of the U.S. attorneys looking very carefully into the Clinton Foundation case that was reopened, we heard, January 4th, 2018. So this is really quite a significant development and calls for this newspaper. I'm going to be in touch with them, actually, to try to get them to really examine the whole truth and not just write this short editorial, which I note is not even an opinion piece. It's by the editorial board of the West Virginia paper.
Well, I want to know, why is it, what do you think is the reason? I mean, we had all this drama associated with Michael Horowitz's report of the Department of Justice. It comes out 568 pages and really doesn't address the Clinton Foundation. I mean, except tangentially, but it does not get into, because I suppose it wasn't designed to specifically focus on the Clinton Foundation. But what is it that all these investigative authorities simply will not tackle and would not give us a detailed report on the Clinton Foundation?
Well, let's examine that by looking at time periods. So if we start, the first time period that I think is relevant is October 23rd, 1997 to 20th January 2001. In that time frame, Bill Clinton is the president of the United States. And it was until Al Gore, you know, lost, it was hoped that Al Gore would follow him up. So it's easy to understand why nothing would happen while Bill was president of the United States, as the Clinton Foundation, in my judgment, looking at the record, began to break the law. Then there's a period from January 20th, 2001 to May of 2013. And that period is interesting because at the beginning of it, from 1 until late December of 5, Lois Lerner, for most of that period, was shifted from the Federal Election Commission into the IRS department that sits on top of charities. And then from January 1st, 2006 until May of 2013, she was actually head of the whole department. So it's easy to understand if Lerner might have been an ally of the Clintons, which I suspect she, if she wasn't an ally of the Clintons, she certainly was a loyal Democrat. She had the ability to stop any investigation from leaving the IRS and get into the Department of Justice. In addition, in the earlier period, 1 through 5, Rod Rosenstein had the ability. He was the man in justice who decided which tax fraud cases would get prosecuted. So, you know, there's a long period here where I don't call them Democrats or Republicans. They're members of the Uniparty. They're members of the swamp. You know, we're situated inside the IRS, situated inside the Department of Justice, and able not only to, as happened with the Tea Party stuff, go after political enemies if they wanted to, but to go soft on political allies. And that's what happened. And this pattern went on and on and on through so many nuances. We know, for example, that an investigation into the Clinton Foundation did, in fact, begin in February of 2001 and went nowhere over the course of about 4 years, even though there's abundant evidence that anybody could see for themselves by Googling William J. Clinton Foundation and FBI Vault. That's William J. Clinton Foundation and FBI Vault shows clearly that an investigation was opened into Bill Clinton and also to Hillary Clinton for public corruption by February of 2015. It shows, in addition, that grand juries were impaneled, but no indictments resulted. And really, the task at hand, I would argue, is to have people who know what they're talking about and have experience with Justice Department filings go into that FBI vault file and examine it and ask, you know, how come Mueller, who was head of the FBI, Comey, who was the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, where this matter was being handled, and how come Rosenstein, who was in Justice Department supposedly policing tax fraud, how come they didn't see the obvious tax fraud that was present? It is present for anybody with experience to see in the public filings of the Clinton Foundation. Why, for 4 years, did they do nothing about it? And could it have been that they felt that maybe George W. would be a one-term president, and, you know, they could just hope that John Kerry would win in November of 2004? And then when that didn't happen, could it have been that they just said, well, you know, we just got to go for broke here, double down, make sure Hillary gets reelected to the Senate, then put her up for president, get her into the White House. And meanwhile, we use our loyal allies stuck into these departments to stall for time. And we'll use our various attorneys, if pressed, to push for extra time and use delaying tactics. So that's, I think, what really happened here and what will make this a very instructive case, not simply to hold people responsible for misdeeds and crimes. This will give us a chance, if it's investigated fully, to figure out how to bring the regulatory apparatus that sits, in theory, over charities into the 21st century so that people are appropriately protected. I mean, the charity sector is a vital, distinctive, wonderful part of what makes America already great, what's made it great for a long time. There's so many, there are millions of people who go and to do charity work willingly because they love it, not looking to make any money, not looking to live off their activities, not looking to push a political career, who do this because they really want to help. And indeed, so many people and so many charities do help. They put their partisan differences to the side, and instead of thinking about party and political advantage, they purely think about how to help disadvantaged people. And sadly, in this richest country on earth, there still are too many disadvantaged people who are not helped by the system, or maybe in some cases can't help themselves. And so, you know, for I would just frankly go out flat out and call them rats, for rats to go into a charity and to use it as a personal enrichment scheme to promote their political office, political ambitions, is diabolically bad. And, you know, that's exactly, in my view, what the Clintons have done from the very beginning with this thing. And, you know, a fresh sets of eyes, not blinded by partisan animus, but people who love charities from across the spectrum need to look at this for what it is expose it for what it has been, and make sure that in the future, this kind of behavior gets stopped well before 21 long years have passed, which is the case of the Clinton Foundation. And after all, you take a newborn and you turn it into an adult who is allowed to drink alcohol in 21 years. That's a long period of time, a lot of change. How did this charity, for almost 21 years, engage in rapacious illegal activities and yet get disciplined by nobody at federal level, nobody by the many foreign countries wherein these people have behaved grossly illegally? How come no foreign leader, no federal prosecutor has decided to go after this mess? It just, I mean, it beggars belief.
Well, it's not just about charity fraud, and I mean, you pointed out the long and stellar history of charities when, of course, they undertook their work with genuine intent to help relieve human suffering, to help essentially fill the gaps that government just could not meet. And they brought the best of themselves to that purpose. Okay, that's fine. But here we have a clear intention to deceive, to steal, and we're talking, I mean, you yourself, you called it the largest unprosecuted charity fraud in history, which means that these folks, the Clintons, entered into this with an entirely different intent from what most charities profess when they enter the world of philanthropy. This is, you talk about proving intent. This is the intent of, I would argue, this is the intent of the Clintons, when for all of these years they specifically organized this mechanism to suit that purpose, to defraud and to provide a shadow, literally a kind of shadow government in which they decided to do whatever it is they wanted to do. And it is therefore all the more alarming because you have all these people in these high places who talk about, you know, the need to follow the law. And for more than 20 years, they could not figure out or they could not see that this was a sham operation. It still is. And that it ended up accounting for billions with a B. Billions of dollars are involved here. So this is a massive crime by any definition. The Democrats couldn't solve the problem. The Republicans can't find the problem. We had the best of the best giving us all kinds of explanations for other crimes that they pursued and prosecuted. And this particular crime has not even been touched.
Right. Because, you see, I think, I hate to use this phrase, but I'll go ahead and use it. I think it is a charity is in some ways a perfect vehicle for international crime. Right? So much of the world is so poor. You go into a poor country as a presidential charity run by, you know, a person who to this day is still admired by too many people, in my judgment. But you go around, fly into some country, a private jet, and announce to that poor country and the leadership of that poor country that you want to help. You want to actually give that country money and that you believe you can not only provide money yourself, but tap into the international streams of money that come out of the World Health Organization, the UN, and the Global Fund, things like that. You'll be welcome with open arms. You're walking into a poor country and you're saying, as the former president of the United States has got the ability to get to almost anybody in the world he needs to get quickly, that you really want to help. And who's going to do the checking? Well, the sad fact is that in the 2 years, 2.5 years, almost 3 years now, I guess, 3 years that I've been at this, we've now finally gotten access to records of multiple government donors. And we see the lies in writing that the Clinton Foundation personnel have told these governments, these donor governments, that gave money to the Clinton Foundation or gave money to projects that are in theory run by the Clinton Foundation. And the Clintons lied to these donors. They lied to the public. They lied to the, the Clinton people lied to the donors. They lied to the countries. They lied to everybody. And the real question for me is, why aren't these donors a lot more suspicious? Why didn't they ask some tough questions? I think the answer is that when you step outside the United States of America, as too few Americans actually do, you grow to understand that America is truly a gigantic, thriving economy, which is many times the size of even an economy like China, filled with, four times as many people as the U.S. Many countries, virtually all countries, even Germany, mighty Germany and mighty Japan, have tiny economies relative to the size of the United States of America. So you're now the leader of Norway or the leader of Belgium or the leader of, you pick it, Hungary, Australia, New Zealand, Sweden. And you can only take your political progress so far inside these smaller economies. Comes a time where you want to be a bigger cheese. The way to be a bigger cheese is to get involved with the UN or to get involved with an arm of the UN or one of these multinational global charities. So these leaders of the many foreign countries, some of which are quite wealthy, whose populations are quite small, are only too happy, it would seem, to get behind a presidential charity, thinking that in this country of ours where we spend $6 trillion a year all in on government, that any presidential charity would in fact be checked rigorously. Well, this is proof positive that at least this one, the Clinton Foundation, and we could also talk about the Obama Foundation, but the Clinton Foundation most certainly has never been checked in the same way that Corinne Brown's charity was checked. Corinne Brown being the former congressperson who is now in prison for 5 years at the age of 71 for having gotten involved in an $800,000 charity fraud that we know about, where the Clintons is at least $2.3 billion in their declared books. So more than let's get the math right here. That is many times bigger than the Corinne Brown charity. So here's Corinne Brown, an African American woman in prison for 5 years, and the Clintons are just still getting away with charity fraud.
But that also speaks to at a certain level in the United States, it does not matter what your politics are, really. It's that you belong to a class of the super privileged. They're all kind of in the same arena, so they're not likely to look into something deeply. I mean, when the Justice Department is actually given the authority to look into things, the FBI has the authority to look into these kinds of things, the IRS has the authority to do it, but won't do it, then we need to ask questions on a broader scale and demand accountability on a broader scale. And I think we're talking about the word purge here. You've got to get these people out because they are partners in crime. This is a major criminal enterprise involving not only the people who are stealing the money and hiding it and moving it around, but they had incredibly effective cover, including from Barack Obama's administration, including from the Clinton administration. They got perfect cover. So this is not an ordinary crime. This is a massive crime. And then, of course, you look at the international angle of it, which you just explained. You have countries around the world choosing not to prosecute these crimes simply because they belong. The crime is occurring in a class of people who are not accustomed to outing each other and prosecuting each other. So what mechanism, because most of the mechanisms that should have worked did not, what mechanisms, if any, are left to unearth, really do an investigation here? The facts are there, the numbers are there, it is evident, in some cases painfully evident, what this foundation was involved in. What mechanisms do you think exist that can still do something about it?
Well, on that front, I think we have some good news. In the first instance, you mentioned at the opening that there's only tangential reference in the Horowitz report to the Clinton Foundation investigation. That actually is a good sign, because what it means, that report was dated last Thursday, what it means is that as of last Thursday anyway, we know there was a Clinton Foundation investigation open in January of 2016 that has not yet resulted in any publicly known indictments. That means that we have two and a half years of work may have been performed on this Clinton Foundation and the array of charities. It's not simply the one based in Little Rock. There are, at least in the United States, there are 12 related ones that I've found so far. And outside the United States, it's difficult to count how many there may be. So we know the FBI has had ample time to look into this. We also have public reports that U.S. attorneys, who would be the ones who would be seeking indictments in various jurisdictions, may have begun work. There have been reports of one in Little Rock, another one in Utah, and yet another one in Dallas, and one perhaps in Chicago and in New York. So it is possible that there are now very advanced processes underway, not simply to discipline the Clinton Foundation, which would be the first step, and it's the allied charities, but then also to discipline the major donors who played along with this fraud, who may have contributed to this fraud as a way to gain influence with a powerful politically connected family, dynastic family in the Clintons that has reach around the world, to discipline the accounting firms and the law firms and others. So it could be that under the current administration, they've taken a view, no, we really do want to stop these abuses. Then this particular case is a good one to focus on, so let's put the resources behind it. And, of course, under our system, you are innocent until proven guilty, so it would be improper for information to leak out of the grand juries into the public domain about the status of these investigations. So I actually view that as a good sign. And I also think that, you know, with the passage of time, when we started on this, Utrice, together two and a half years ago or so, there was a political campaign still underway. And Hillary Clinton could very well have been president of the United States. And thankfully, neither you nor I are interested in getting political offices. At least I'm not. And I think you're not. So we didn't really have much to lose from a political perspective taking on this powerful family. But that's not the way it works for most Americans. And as you get richer and more involved in business and whatever, the government gets more and more intrusive, and you get more and more worried about making an enemy of somebody who has been seen in the past to be vindictive with her husband. The last thing you'd want to do if you're a very powerful, politically connected person is to take on the Clintons before you know the result of the election. So that's why I think a lot of people, the smart money was all on Hillary winning in a walk, in a breeze. And then, when Trump won, the smart money was all about getting him impeached and he was going to be out and this and that. And so in the early period, the insiders in the United States just couldn't really think cogently, I don't think, about the possibility that this Clinton Foundation could be the kind of fraud I think it is. And could then have also infected not only the Obama Foundation, but also various Bush foundations, so that the extent of this infects what we call the uniparty. Then outside the country, you have a situation where a lot of current and former world leaders have massive egg on face. I mean, either their own security systems did not see this fraud for what it is, which says a lot about whatever monies they may be spending on security, or they did see it, and they were trying to use this knowledge as a lever to improve their influence against the United States government. Either way, it's a very embarrassing set of stories for the many countries in which this Clinton Foundation has claimed to operate. And we're not talking here about two countries. We're talking about, I think, the last count, it's more than 70 different countries is the number I came up with. Could be even more than that. So a lot of people have a lot of egg on face. A lot of people have been trying to wish this problem away. But the bad news is that, you know, after a while, water wears away rock. And the water that we've been pouring on this thing for two years plus, has finally gotten the rock out of the way in enough of these foreign countries and in enough states, U.S. states, that, you know, there is not the ability any longer to just brush this away. This fraud is known, in my opinion. This fraud will not stand. The only question is how much of the story will get told, in my mind. Will the Clintons get away, as has happened in the past, with, you know, confessing to a small portion of the crime and then, you know, convincing the powers that be that, you know, let's let bygones be bygones. We can't have the current administration go after the losing candidate. What a bad precedent that will set. We'll be deemed a banana republic, if we, you know, that kind of argument. Or will people look at this with clear eyes and say, you know what, this has been going on for too long. It involves Republicans and Democrats alike. It is too profound. It is too disgusting. We can't let this. We're not going to sweep this under the rug. In fact, we're going to use it as a precedent so we can say for the rest of time, you know, when we're speaking about charity, you don't want to do charity Clinton style. Because when you do it Clinton style, all of your assets disappear and you lose your freedom. And you're made an example of. And you, no longer can this behavior be tolerated in the way it has evidently been tolerated in the past. So it's moving, I think. It takes time. It was a big job to get into this. And it's taken time for the public to sort of understand just how serious the problem is, and then to see a window how this can actually be a win-win. I mean, I think why this likely will be fully exposed is that it is in the interest of the Democratic Party now to expunge Clintonism. It is in their interest. And there are enough smart people are beginning to see this in the Democratic Party. Indeed, I noticed a candidate, I forget the person's first name, but his last name is Tucker in Arkansas, who is running for Democratic seat in Congress. I don't know that he's yet made it through the Arkansas primary, but he's a candidate. And others in their 30s and 40s and 50s are going to look at this and say, you know what, we've had Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton have been on the national stage since 1992. You know, their time has passed. And, you know, Obama was not strong enough to face the Clintons down. He let the Clinton Foundation fraud expand. We don't yet know why. You know, his time has passed. It's time now for the rising generation in their 30s and their 40s and 50s in the Democratic Party. And, you know, what better way to show that you're a statesperson and a patriot than to take the Clintons on and win? And so
there's another matter here, and that is, as you mentioned, the passage of time. Does that in any way affect the ability of any entity to prosecute the Clintons for this kind of fraud, owing to statutes that might apply? I'm not sure what they would be, but it's a question. Would the passage of time, without any prosecutorial action, basically make the case that, well, it's too late to prosecute them on these crimes? That's one. Number two, there's a sympathy factor. Bill Clinton is not well, and the argument might go that, well, you know, to prosecute him in his state of health is only to aggravate his condition, whatever it is. And nobody wants to be responsible for hastening the death of a president. So to what degree are these two factors playing into the delay in vigorously prosecuting the Clintons?
I'll answer the second part of that question first. So in other words, what you're saying, and I'm really just kidding here, you're saying that what we want to do is give Slick Willie a chance to become Thick Willie and thereby get out of trouble for a virtual lifetime of charity fraud. No, I don't think there's much sympathy for that, nor should there be sympathy for that. As to the statute of limitations question, as your audience said, you know, I am not a lawyer. But I do work with lawyers, and they tell me, and I see with my own eyes, that some crimes, fade away over time. But what one might argue, and as a private citizen has argued in a private racketeering lawsuit that was filed on June 15th, that this is a pattern and practice of racketeering, and it's a conspiracy. And so the statute of limitations, I'm told, for a conspiracy is triggered when the conspiracy becomes known. This conspiracy is very much ongoing, particularly if you think of it as a frame of the suit as a conspiracy to obstruct justice. There's a rich panoply of potential crimes. You could fill page after page of, ream after ream of paper when you started thinking about state crimes and federal crimes and foreign crimes. I'm told, though, that the way this works ordinarily is that the IRS has the charity department. At one point, it was headed by Lois Lerner. And when the IRS decides to open an investigation into a charity, what they focus on are the facts, and they look hard at the known facts, and they ask themselves all kinds of questions. But the first set of questions they tend to ask is, for what purposes, what specific purposes was the charity organized? And there are facts on that. You have to fill an application with the IRS on Form 1023, where you state exactly what your specific purposes are. You also are asked questions which are meant to tease out any defects in your record. And you fill that application out, you date it, you sign it under penalties of perjury, and on the basis of that application and other follow-up questions that may be asked, which are asked and answered in writing, the IRS grants you what I would argue, just as being as a layman, is a conditional authority to operate as a federally tax-exempt entity. But that, why I say it's conditional, the IRS is specifically saying, listen, based on what you told us, we're giving you this conditional right to operate without paying federal taxes on your activities and to offer your donors the chance to take a federal tax deduction for a portion of their donation. And what happens, though, is that when the IRS learns of behavior that, let's say, wasn't described in that Form 1023, or that you veered off with what you said you were going to do and did something different, they look into the facts, and they ask you questions, and they make a determination. And if they've decided that you behaved in ways not contemplated or not allowed, they have the right to retroactively revoke your right to do what you've done, and to say, hey, you know what? You thought you were a charity, didn't have to pay federal taxes. In fact, we believe you were a business. And you, therefore, we're going to calculate your bill. We think that on the activities of the charity, you've generated a profit. That is, your revenues have been greater than your expenses. We're going to dun you for federal tax, corporate income taxes. We're going to dun you for interest. We're going to dun you for penalties. And then we're going to go to your donors, your significant donors, and say, listen, you took a tax deduction for a donation to an entity that's not a charity. In fact, it's a business. We want the benefit of your tax deduction back with penalties and interest. That's the way it does, in fact, work and has worked and probably was working right now on charities. But it's never yet happened to a charity as big as this, to a charity connected to a former president, to an aspiring president, to a daughter who now thinks that she speaks for the people of America and is advising people not to listen to the president of the United States because, you know, Chelsea Clinton knows more about what the people want than the president does. So, I mean, you have a very politically active dynastic family, which is you know, was dead broke when Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton were living in the White House. Today, Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea are all living as multi-billionaires, you know, with a, off the fat of the land, having magically gone from being dead broke and poor to now being multi-billionaires, and nobody's asking the type of questions that should be asked. And why is this dangerous? Because if the Clintons get away with this, you know, time will pass. They will set a precedent. And people will say, well, the Clintons only, you know, they scammed $200 million. I'm going to scan $50 billion doing the same thing. We can't let this happen.
Well, let me ask you about a different dimension to this debacle here. And it's not just about theft and, you know, pay for play. It's also something that I would imagine would conjure up treason. When the Clintons decided to arrange with Moscow the sale of 20% of U.S. uranium, and they netted from that one little deal, a nifty little deal, $145 million. Where in the scheme of things as we understand it now does an act like that figure? It's not just about stealing the money or anything like that. It's also about trading the resources of a country to another country, which is supposedly not an ally, and trading in very high-value materials that could give that country a military advantage, uranium. You get $145 million, nobody knows where it is. But I'm focusing on the nature of the transaction. And what do you call that? Is that treasonous, or is that just basically a transaction, a business transaction? How do you classify a crime like that?
I classify it as public corruption, bribery, treason, maybe sedition. I mean, what I think has happened, and not to pick solely on Democrats, what's happened really in the period 1988 forward is the glitterati, you know, the political class, the media elites, the corporate bigwigs, the investor types, the big bankers, embraced the notion of globalism, unregulated globalism. And, you know, it's so 20th century to be thinking in terms of national interests. And so this project of creating an international globalist sort of elite was a project embraced across the political spectrum. And why not, many would argue? I mean, why do we need these pesky little nations? We've got a planet to run here. We've got planetary causes we need to do. We've got planetary profit opportunities. And, you know, these national laws that make insider trading difficult, as you say, treason difficult, they fall away if we embrace the notion that, you know, these little, you know, nations, they don't matter anymore. You know, we're all part of the globalist elite. We're doing this for the betterment of mankind. You know, and people on the right and the left, you know, could feel happy about it. The academic elites love it. You know, at these universities, they're principally in the richer countries. Instead of just getting Americans to go to Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, now you've got a global applicant pool, many times greater, and often the, you know, highly, highly qualified people, many more spaces available for the same number of slots on campus. And suddenly, you know, as the leader of a Harvard, Yale, or Princeton, or the big universities, that you're set for your lives. I mean, you'll never have to worry getting qualified candidates. You'll have all sorts of global projects you can pursue. You'll have all these big donors around the world who want to give your university money and maybe get you involved in investment schemes. You know, you just look around. It's a perfect opportunity. Instead of trying to comply with, yes, you know, the Securities Exchange Commission alone in the United States, suddenly you could say you've got a globalist project, and, you know, no national law really should regulate you. And so it was easy to understand why all of this would sound like it's good. The profiteers in investments, in banking, et cetera, and multinational companies, they loved it. Academics loved it. Journalists loved it. It was one big happy party. And, but then you start thinking about it through a different set of eyes. You say, listen, the Bushes, then Clinton, and Obama, you were each given the charge of swearing when you took the oath of office to preserve and protect the Constitution of the United States, not to promote the interests of an unregulated globalist elite. And it's not a technical little thing you did. I mean, you swore before the world, before your citizenry to do that. And now, you know, when we think about this idea of what people should care about with the mishandling of classified information, I love the way journalists who are not thoughtful try to frame it as, well, Hillary Clinton, you know, she just used a personal email account like Colin Powell. People do that. That's not what Hillary Clinton did. And that's not what Barack Obama did. Some group of people allowed the President of the United States and somebody in the Secretary of State, who I think was like fourth or fifth in line of succession, the very powerful people, to operate 100% of the business of the United States concerning foreign powers using a secret server system that was not properly vetted. And I jokingly refer to this as allowing, you know, a new movie called On Her Majesty's Secret Server. I mean, who authorized the idea? Nobody. In Mueller's FBI, he was leading the FBI. Did nobody in our security services say, the incoming Obama team, listen, we understand over here that the Clintons think they're going to be running the State Department 100% of their business on secret servers. Yeah, you can't do that. And how did that
go? Well, the reason I asked the question was to get some clarity on the quality of the crimes that, of course, span the gamut and
right.
With the Clintons. When a former president, and at that time, too, you could say that he had just got out of office, but he was a president of the United States. You have a secretary of state. She was in office at the time that all of this was being done, who aspired to be president of the United States. There is no doubt that they understood what treason was about when they decided to trade the property, if you will, of the United States for private gain. This business of the Uranium One was no ordinary transaction. They were actually selling off or trading in the property of the United States, if you will. And we still don't know where the money is, where the money went.
Right.
So on top of the regular thievery, we have a specialty area here in which much of the money that they ended up with was money that came out of transactions such as this, where the Clintons basically put up for sale the assets of the country and privately pocketed the proceeds thereof. They knew because of the positions that they held, because they are lawyers and they should have understood what it is they were doing, that this was no ordinary crime. This was a special kind of crime. And for that, since other authorities have come to learn about the Uranium One deal, for example, and others like it, one would imagine that there'd be more exercise than ever, because these are not ordinary crimes, to proceed vigorously with investigations, but it appears that they did not.
Right. So I think what the Clintons are very good at doing, and I'm saying this in quotes, very good, is involving other people, making them complicit in their criminal activity. And, you know, as a guess, what they threatened, if it might be the right word, the Obama people with is, look, you know, if the wheels of justice are turned into our direction, we become defendants in a criminal matter, you should understand that one of our defenses is going to be, you knew about this. And, you know, when you think about, I mean, I have no idea and don't want to know the level of security that our federal government does attempt to put in place to protect our national interests and our secrets from the prying eyes of foreign powers. I hope that we have legendary, you know, amazing capabilities that can be brought to bear on sussing out powers that are trying to steal our secrets, as well as sussing out people who are willing to sell our secrets to the highest bidder or are lax in mishandling our secrets. And so the first question I would be asking is, why in the heck? I would understand the first day, you know, your first day on the job, you roll into the Secretary of State's office. You see pictures of it. It's beautiful. You're admiring the artwork. You're figuring out where to hang your coat. It's cold out there. You're calling your friends up, you know, and say, hey, you're not going to believe how beautiful this place is. And you do something by mistake. You know, I can imagine that happening. But to operate the State Department for 4 years exclusively using a private server that is not checked, evidently, carefully enough, and then to not sign or not remember signing the required paperwork that you're supposed to sign coming in and leaving concerning your knowledge of security procedures, and then to retain control over all this information in your private hands for almost 2 years, and nobody, you know, Mueller doesn't make an issue of it, Comey doesn't make an issue of it. It just, it's mind-boggling to me how many people had to know what the guns were up to, and how many of those people might include Valerie Jarrett, Barack Obama, maybe John Kerry, others. How many people knew about this? And if nobody knew about this, then, you know, very clearly the systems that need to be in place have to be radically changed.
Well, Charles, this has been a great conversation as usual. It's always great talking to you to get an entirely different perspective on what people think is a, you know, a straight standard issue kind of thing, with only the personnel adding to the exceptional nature of the crimes that we've been talking about. But I thank you for being with us today and giving us an update on where this stands, and we look forward to having you again on soon.
Anytime, Etrice, thank you.
Are you there? Okay, thanks. Okay, that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope you found it informative. And we'll soon schedule a Q&A just about the subject. But as you can tell, you are the beneficiaries of information that nobody else really has, because people are devoting a great deal of time to researching and getting at the nut of the problem. This has been an endeavor we've been involved in for more than 2 years. And we just continue. The more we find out, the more we are able to share with you. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. And we'll see each other tomorrow, Free Your Mind Friday. Bye-bye.